deliver a yardside shiur l'zecher nishmas, his father, Rabbi Reichman, when he was with us this past Shabbos, when we had the Kol Mitzion together with the Reed Summer Kolel, mentioned that the Midah of Chesed and the Midah of Gevura are antithetical to each other in nature, and the Tafkid of Klal Yisrael is to unify those two Midos. And he spoke about in last week's parsha, Midyan and Moav represent, Midyan from the word Midan represents Din. It's the extreme of the inability to take Rachamim, and it ultimately involves into the concept of Esav, which comes from the Gevura of Yitzchak. In contrast to Moav coming from Avram Avinu, the notion of Chesed to extreme, Erva coming from Chesed. Also, if an individual has Chesed that's not mitigated with Gevuras, then ultimately it can morph into something that is quite dangerous. To have in Chinuch the ability to be Metzdarev both Din and Chesed is something that's very necessary, but also quite difficult. There's some people who are Dayanim, and they represent Din. They represent Din even from the perspective of Torah. But those individuals who represent that perspective of Din, sometimes to be able to relate Berachmanus to the state of Talmidim is something that's not easy. And then there are some people who are Mechanchim, who are tremendous Gomlei Chasadim, but it's a little bit difficult for them to manifest the Bechina of Din. There are some who could be Mitzdarif, those two worlds. And Rav Ries, as a Dayan, and also as one of the most important Mechanchim in Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, is someone who's that. So we're very lucky that the Talmidim of the Summer Kolel have the ability to hear on a very, very momentous day for Rabbi Ries a yardside shiur on the prenuptial agreement.
Thank you very, very much, Rav Eisenstein, Reshusa, Rav Miller Shlita, and other Rabbanim Chashuvim, Rav Ben Narsh, Rav Silverman, distinguished guests. I want to thank Rav Eisenstein for stalling until my mother arrived. Thank you very much. Oh, okay. And for introducing the topic of this year's Yurtzeit Shir, Luzecha Ravi Mori, Tzvi Ben Ephraim HaKohen. The topic that I chose to speak about today is the topic relating to tanoim, to conditions that are made specifically in the context of a prenuptial agreement. We just read this past Shabbos, double parsha, Matos Maseh, and of course, Parshas Matos is famous for the section detailing the Tanai b'nei Gad u'b'nei Reuven, when there were conditions that were stipulated between Moshe Rabbeinu and between these tribes regarding their desire to sojourn, to stay on the eastern side of the Jordan River, Be'ever HaYarden, and there were conditions that were set that if they would pass over the Yarden and fight on behalf of B'nei Yisrael, in order to enable all of Klal Yisrael to settle in Eretz Yisrael proper, so then they would be entitled to receive their lands on the lands that they coveted on the eastern side of the Jordan River. And from this condition, this set of conditions that was articulated between Moshe and between these tribes, we derive all about how conditions are supposed to be stipulated in general. All of the laws of Tanoim basically are derived from the Tanai B'nei Gad U'B'nei Reuven. Therefore, I think it is appropriate to speak about the types of Tanaim that get stipulated nowadays. It's also appropriate because the Tanaim in question were detailed conditions about how the land was going to be settled and who would receive what portion of the land to be used for what purpose and so forth. And my father, Zichrono Livracha, as will be appreciated by some in the audience, in his capacity as a town councilman in the town of Ramapo, had to deal with these thorny issues on a regular basis. of who should live where, and what parts of the town should be set aside for this population, for that population. At the same time, my father also appreciated that the ultimate Nachala was on the other side of Eber HaYarden. He was very, very distant from the Eber HaYarden, more to the west than over to the east. But my father's ultimate Nachala was always in Eretz Yisrael. He visited Eretz Yisrael frequently, had a tremendous love for the land, developed a twinning committee between the town of Ramapo and the town of Beit Shemesh, and also ultimately was buried in Har HaZeisim in Yerushalayim, which I visited the other day. When you think about prenuptial agreements nowadays, since there is a bombardment of publicity probably about the importance of entering into some sort of prenuptial agreement upon marriage, generally we speak about the prenuptial agreement relating to aguna issues. We want to resolve aguna issues, make sure that women should not be deprived of a get if a marriage doesn't work out. And there's a prenuptial agreement that was formulated by the Beis Din of America, which I served as director for a number of years, under the authorship of Rabbi Mordechai Willig Shlita, based on a form from the Nachla Shiva from a few hundred years ago that articulates that the parties agree that in the event of a separation, they will appear before a certain Beis Din, and also that the husband will provide a certain amount of support for his wife at the time of a separation. And this provides, number one, for the ability of Beis Din to oversee any dispute regarding a get so that the woman wouldn't be an aguna. And number two, also provides for a default monetary obligation that also provides for an incentive to give a get if the marriage is really over. So I'm actually not going to speak about that type of prenuptial agreement today. I'm going to speak about the more popular prenuptial agreement that is more well-known in secular parlance. And I have a launching pad for this discussion from this past week's Friday Jerusalem Post. On the front page of the front lines section of the Jerusalem Post, there's apparently a regular columnist who writes at the bottom. And the columnist is a financial planner of sorts. And he writes that he creates financial plans with clients. And he also encourages them to enter, when appropriate, into prenuptial agreements. And he points out that there are two types of prenuptial agreements. One is prenuptial agreement that I just described regarding get issues and how to avoid aguna situations. And the other is a standard prenuptial agreement that many couples enter into when they get married, which helps to define which assets belong to the husband, which assets belong to the wife. So in the event that, unfortunately, there ever is a divorce, it would be made clear that each party would get to keep the assets they brought into the marriage, and it also serves other financial purposes whenever parties enter into this type of agreement. When do we usually have husbands and wives, when they get married, entering into this type of an agreement? So you have it very often with respect to second marriages. When people have accumulated substantial assets on their own, they already have children that they support from previous marriages, they don't necessarily know how well or how long this marriage will last, and even if it lasts wonderfully, they want to preserve what they have already earned for the children from their first marriage. So therefore, such parties are more likely to enter into these agreements that basically sets forth, regardless of what the laws or even halachos would otherwise provide, we're stipulating that what we bring in will always remain ours, and we're not going to be sharing our assets with each other for perennial purposes. It also sometimes presents itself, in my experience, when you have a first marriage where there is a disproportionate amount of wealth in favor of one of the parties as opposed to the other one. And there's a fear that maybe even the parents, in-laws have, who knows if the marriage will last. And we want to make sure that the other person is not going to run away with a windfall and rob the family of all of its wealth. And therefore, in such a case as well, if you have a very wealthy wife and not such a wealthy husband, or vice versa, they might enter into this type of prenuptial agreement. So I gave a seminar about a year ago. in Philadelphia with a divorce attorney to speak about prenuptial agreements. I was brought in because of my expertise mostly on the Aguna side, and this attorney was a secular attorney who was brought in to discuss prenuptial agreements on the secular side, and we were focusing really on different areas. I was focusing on the first type of prenup, and she was focusing on the second type of prenup, but it was a learning experience for me because I was able to decipher from her presentation some of the more popular provisions that are included in these types of prenuptial agreements. And even my time in the Beis Din, sometimes I would have a couple getting married who would want our standard Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement, and they would say, oh, by the way, we're entering into a standard secular prenup agreement. How do we incorporate both of them? And we had a certain formulation of our prenup that enabled parties to kind of incorporate it as one section from their prenuptial document. You know, you add something like, notwithstanding the foregoing, the parties agree, blah, 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 blah. But I certainly knew that these existed, that these agreements existed, but what became more fascinating to me is the awareness that there are halakhic issues that arise even in the context of secular prenuptial agreements, and I wanted to discuss a couple of them in the time that we have today. First of all, when it comes to setting conditions, so halakha allows, as a general rule, for parties to establish monetary conditions with each other in their contracts. This is a machlokis that is brought in the Gemara in Ksuvos on a daf nun vav amud aleph, a machlokis between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda as to whether a person is allowed to make monetary conditions that go against what otherwise would be stipulated in the Torah. So according to the Torah, for example, a man has to provide for his wife. Can a couple make a condition at the time of marriage when the man turns to his wife and says, even though I'm supposed to provide for you, you're married to me, you are hereby married to me on condition that I don't have to provide for you. So does this, I don't have to provide food for you, I don't have to provide clothing for you, does this condition work? Is this an effective condition or not? So Rabbi Meir says, this is not an effective condition. That hamasne mashikasu b'torah tina'o batil. If somebody makes a condition against what is otherwise required by somebody to perform according to the Torah, then the condition is invalid. And Rabbi Yehuda says, no, hamasne mashikasu b'torah tina'o kayim, that if we're dealing with a davashib b'mamon, if we're dealing with a monetary condition, so even though the monetary law according to the Torah might be otherwise, nonetheless we allow individuals to make a condition against what would otherwise be required monetarily by the Torah. This is also sometimes formulated in a more succinct fashion as kol tnai shebemamon kayam. Every single condition in monetary matters is considered to be valid. Parties can stipulate as they wish. And the halakha is codified according to Rabbi Yehuda, that even if you want to enter into this prenuptial arrangement where upon marriage parties agree the husband will not support the wife, they have the right to do so, and it is considered to be a binding contract, and the marriage is valid, subject to such a condition. The reason why this works is explained differently by different authorities. According to the Rashba, it essentially boils down to the right of mechila, that people can be meichel each other. Somebody commits even a tort towards you. They cause damage to your property, so they might otherwise have to pay you, but you could be meichel. You could say, I'm meichel. We forgive each other for sins. We forgive each other for all kinds of things. You can be meichel, a monetary obligation. So we're meichel, their monetary obligation towards us. The Ramban has a slightly different formulation in Baba Basra, Daf Kufka Vav Amud Beis. The Ramban says that monetary obligations never really get off the ground. Elamei Ritzon El Shelsheni. Their monetary obligations are always between two parties. The first party doesn't owe the second party unless the second party wants. Second party doesn't want, so then it doesn't really get off the ground. According to either explanation, this is only applicable with respect to monetary matters. If there was going to be a downright ritual prohibition, an iser was going to be committed in the course of the transaction, so then we can understand, according to either explanation, why it would be invalid to make a condition. If you say that it is based upon mechila, it's based upon forgiveness, so we are not the owners of our ritual obligations, our obligation to eat kosher, our obligation to keep Shabbos. We're not the bialim. We're not the owners over such conditions. We can't be meichel them. We can't say to each other, don't worry, you don't have to keep Shabbos. I'm meichel you. It's not up to me. It's up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wasn't meichel. He didn't forgive the person, so I can't forgive the person from keeping Shabbos or performing anything else, which is an actual Torah requirement and not merely in the monetary realm. And according to the Ramban, the conditions of Issa v'Heter, the conditions of ritual prohibition, have nothing to do with whether I desire it or not. And even if I desire in the worst possible way to eat pig, I'm still not allowed to eat the pig, as Rashi comments in Sefer Vayikra. So therefore, when it comes to Isser, when it comes to matters of prohibition, as opposed to matters of mamon, as opposed to monetary conditions, the conditions will not be valid. And therefore, one has to look very closely at every single condition, even if you think that it's monetary, to make sure that it doesn't fall within the framework of what might not be permitted in the context of permissible conditions according to halacha. Sometimes you might have a condition that looks like it's purely monetary in nature, but it's not. For example, we enter into a transaction in which I'm going to charge interest of you. The Torah says you're not allowed to charge interest. This is not merely a monetary issue. It's not, you won't find the halachos of ribbis in Choshen Mishpat. This is an Issa v'Heter issue. You'll find the halachos of ribbis in Yoredeya. Even if both parties agree, normally that's how ribbis transactions get transacted. Both parties agree that they're going to have an interest-bearing transaction. The Torah nonetheless forbids it, so you can't be meichel it because you can't just forgive it, because this is something which the Torah absolutely requires as a ritual prohibition. But those who are drafting monetary documents, lawyers and the like, might not necessarily always have this sensitivity in mind that there are certain types of monetary provisions that might actually be, in reality, ritual prohibitions. So I'd like to focus on two specific clauses in standard monetary prenuptial agreements that raise significant halakhic issues. One is with respect to a waiver of any rights of either party to receive any money following the marriage from each other. This is one of the standard clauses. The clause might be expressed in one of two different ways. Either it will be expressed in terms of inheritance language. The husband waives any rights to his wife's estate, the wife waives any rights to her husband's estate. Or it might go even further and say that even if we're not talking about the situation of death, but we're talking about a situation of divorce, they also waive any rights to receive what we call alimony or maintenance from each other, any continued support from each other. And this is a standard type of prenuptial clause, especially when dealing with two parties who are already relatively well off. And they understand that if it works out, wonderful, they'll stay together. And if it doesn't work out, or if somebody dies, they're not looking to become rich or to become sustained in any way off of the other party. So we mentioned that to waive support during marriage, so this is something that Rabbi Yehuda countenances as a davashib mamun. But what about waiving support after marriage, either in the event of death or divorce? So we know that when speaking about a husband's obligations towards a wife, one of the most fundamental obligations that a husband has is with respect to giving his wife a ksuva. The ksuva is an amount of money that has to be paid from the husband to the wife. The main part of the ksuva is 200 zuz. Truthfully, 200 zuz does not necessarily translate to a huge amount of money. Nowadays, if we're just going to break it down to the pure silver value of how we would measure zuz, there are 50 shkolim in 200 zuz. If you break it down to pidyon habein amounts, 5 shkolim of pidyon habein is worth about 100 grams of silver. 50 shkolim is about 1,000 grams of silver. It comes out nowadays, if you're just going to measure it in terms of the grams of silver, it comes out to probably a little less than $1,000 nowadays. But nonetheless, the husband has this absolute obligation to give his wife the ikar ksuva, the main part of the ksuva, which is 200 zuz upon the event of death or divorce. And there are some poskim, and this is actually perhaps gaining in popularity. I saw a tshuva by Duchovsky on this issue not so long ago, but you'll find this in the writings of Rav Libis, the former head Av Bezdin of the Igud HaRabbanim in America, where Rav Libis also writes in his tshuvos that perhaps if you look at the Mishnayos in Peah and the Yerushalmi in Peah, we see that 200 zuz is essentially defined as the bare minimum amount that a person needs in order to sustain himself over the course of a year without having to resort to charity funds. And therefore, he argues that when we're defining the 200 zuz of the Ksuva, you should look at any point in time, at any point in history, upon what is the base amount that a person needs in order to sustain themselves over the course of a year. In which case, it might be significantly larger than $1,000 or whatever the strict amount would be. So what happens if you have this type of a waiver in a prenuptial agreement? Does that include the ksuva? Does it not include the ksuva? If it does include the ksuva, we have a serious problem on our hands, because the Mishnah in Ksuvos and Daf Nun Dalet Amud Beis quotes Rabbi Meir, who says, "Kol ha'poches le'besula mimasayim le'amona mimona." Anybody who gives a besula less than 200 zuz, for an amona it's less, and so it's 100 zuz, even calculated differently, harezu be'ilas nus, then that would be considered to be a be'ilas nus, that would be considered a marriage which is essentially illegitimate. It's essentially an illegitimate marriage. And in fact, the way that we paskin the halacha, the Gemara later on, Daf Nun Vav Amud Beis, is that the tanai would be batel. The tanai would be an invalid condition. Well, if the tanai is an invalid condition, and then the man marries the wife, so maybe then we would never have a problem because the condition is invalid, and then they're just married. So says the Rambam, it doesn't quite work that way. Shulchan Aruch says as well that the problem is that the woman thinks that the condition is valid. She thinks the condition is valid. Therefore, she thinks she's not getting her ksuva money. She thinks she's not getting her ksuva money. Therefore, the marriage is illegitimate because we require that a woman have the security of knowing that she is going to receive her ksuva money. Shalotehe kala be'enav lahotzia, that the husband, as the Gemara says in many places, should not precipitously feel that he can easily divorce his wife without paying the ketubah, and therefore their entire relationship would be an illegitimate relationship, what we call bi'ilas nus, according to halakha. They would be prohibited from actually living together. So, do they then face that prohibition if they entered into this type of prenuptial agreement? It's interesting. There was actually a secular court case in the 1970s in the New York court system called In Re Estate of White, involving the White family. And what happened there is that Mr. White entered into a marriage with a woman. I don't know if she took on the name Mrs. White. Let's assume for argument's sake, Mrs. White. And they entered into a prenuptial agreement pursuant to which they waived all rights of inheritance from each other. And then what happened was that Mr. White died, and Mrs. White, I think, died too. But the estate wanted to collect from Mr. White whatever the obligations were, according to secular law, that would have to be paid to a widow. And they claimed that notwithstanding the prenuptial agreement, since there was a subsequent ksuva that was entered into between the parties, the ketubah overrided the prenuptial agreement, and therefore whatever obligations were set forth in the ketubah of 200 zuz, of the Tosefis ksuva, I think in that case it was, I don't remember if she was the first marriage or second marriage, let's assume 200 zuz, the Tosefis ksuva for 200 zukukim of silver, which is a much more significant amount, that these were all payable because the ksuva would override the prenuptial agreement. And they further argued that these amounts roughly coincided with whatever obligations would have existed under the secular law. And the judge, the secular court judge in that case, threw out the contention of the wife's heirs, and he said that this cannot be the case, because everybody knows the ketubah document is really intended to be just a religiously ceremonial document, and if in fact it was meant to have any real teeth, then it would have been entered into with the same legal formalities as the monetary prenuptial agreement. Therefore, according to the judge's interpretation, the intention of the parties was to waive everything in the monetary prenuptial agreement, even what would be subsequently registered in the ketubah, and that he ascertained that he thought that this would be the intention of the parties as well. And not only did the judge in the case of re-estate of White deal with this issue, but the Divrei Malkiyo dealt with this issue. The Divrei Malkiyo in Chelek Dalet, Simen Kuf Nun Hey, the Divrei Malkiyo deals with a similar prenuptial agreement that two parties entered into, which basically stipulated that in the event of death, neither party would inherit anything from each other. And he said, halakhically speaking, the provision makes no sense, because a husband, we know, as we're going to discuss in a moment, does inherit his wife. But a wife, according to halakha, does not actually halakhically inherit her husband. She's entitled to the ksuva, but she doesn't inherit her husband. Children, sons, daughters, if there are no sons, inherit the husband, as we know from the Benos Tzlafchot. But the wife does not inherit the husband. So what does the provision mean, that the wife's not going to get anything from the husband's estate? So it probably means that she's waiving the ksuva. So that's the question. So he deals with the issue of whether there's any way in the world to justify a waiver of the ksuva. And he points out that, in fact, it can't be because the halakha does not prohibit a woman to waive the ksuva. But then in the end, he says that, in his opinion, it must be the case that this is not what the intention of the parties was, that the fact that the provision in the agreement says that the wife waives her right to inherit the husband, that's only because, he said, we're dealing with people who are not so knowledgeable about halakha. We're dealing with lawyers who drafted the document who don't really know anything about halakha, so they put it in just kind of because in the secular worldview, this is something that might otherwise happen. But of course, it's absolutely meaningless from a halakhic perspective, and we shouldn't read too much into it. And of course, by virtue of this type of a clause, there's no question that the woman was in any way agreeing to waive her ksuva. So this becomes a question, though, when you're drafting a prenuptial agreement for knowledgeable parties who are members of the Orthodox community, who presumably should know about such things, and certainly lechatchila, as an initial matter, should avoid these types of potential issues of entering into a marriage which, God forbid, the entire relationship could be deemed as illegitimate according to halakha. It certainly behooves one to be careful to not imply in the language of any waiver of a prenuptial agreement that the wife is acquiescing to a waiver of the ksuva, particularly if the parties know that as a matter of secular law in New York, a judge would read this and say that the parties are essentially waiving any rights under the ksuva as well if they enter into a sweeping waiver language in the prenuptial document. And in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, I received a shaila from a rav of a community in America, who said that he is preparing to marry a certain couple in his community, and it's one of the parties, the wife's father is a prominent attorney, and not somebody who necessarily was knowledgeable about halakha, but he was concerned because his child and this couple were entering together into a prenuptial agreement. And in the prenuptial agreement, it had all kinds of waivers and so forth that weren't necessarily consistent with whatever the ksuva amount would be. Remember, ksuva has the 200 zuz that you are absolutely non-negotiable, and it also has the 200 zukukim of silver, which according to Rav Moshe Feinstein is worth 100 pounds of silver, which nowadays is a nice chunk of money. It could be as much as $40,000. It's a nice chunk of money. And he wanted to make it clear that there was no contradiction between whatever was in the ksuva and whatever was in the prenuptial agreement. Maybe it was even the husband's father. And he asked, could we insert a clause in the ksuva that says that in the event there's a conflict between the provisions of the ketubah and the provisions of the prenuptial agreement, it should be understood that the prenuptial agreement shall govern. That the prenuptial agreement, of course, should supersede the ksuva. So there shouldn't be any ambiguity. He was worried that, you know, maybe they wouldn't even be savvy enough to follow the New York court case of the 90s. He wanted to make it explicit in the ksuva that the prenuptial agreement should override the ksuva. So I said to this Rav, if you're going to insert a provision anywhere, you have to insert it in the prenuptial agreement, and you have to stipulate very clearly that the prenuptial agreement doesn't override the ksuva. That it would be, in fact, an illegitimate marriage if you're going to override the ksuva and not have the basic core ksuva obligation going from the husband to the wife, and therefore you have to make crystal clear not that the ksuva shouldn't override the prenuptial agreement, but that the prenuptial agreement should not override the ketubah, and that in fact it's a good idea to include this type of language in prenuptial agreements in general. Now, one thing that parties could do, if they really are dead set on the notion of foreclosing their rights of from each other and the wife not receiving anything from the husband after the marriage, is that she could agree that she will content herself with the ikra ksuva, with the 200 zuz. Because the Rama writes that it's perfectly legitimate to waive the tosefis ksuva, anything which we customarily add on to the main essential part of the ksuva, as long as the ikra ksuva is actually paid. So therefore, the parties could agree that they're going to stipulate that the only amount that will be paid is the ikar ksuva. The further question that you might ask is whether the parties could even go further and say, well, we know there's a machlokis. We know there's a dispute about how you're going to define the ikar ksuva. That there are those who will say, yeah, just define it in terms of 1,000 grams of silver. And then there are those who say, no, you have to look at what is a minimum threshold of 1 year of sustenance. So let's say that the parties want to keep it as small as possible, and they say we'll adopt the view that measures it purely in terms of silver, and therefore we know that it's probably, unless silver goes up even more enormously than it has the last number of years, it's probably going to be a more manageable amount than what might otherwise be the alternative. So lefi aniyus daiti, this could be subject to dispute. Lefi aniyus daiti, it would be improper even to do that, because they don't know, objectively speaking, which shita is correct. And if they should get it wrong and choose a shita which could objectively be determined by a proper bezdin not to be the shita that should have been followed, then you run afoul of what the Rambam says explicitly, that if you are poches mi besula mi mesayim zuz, that if you actually have less, even though you're giving a ksuva amount, but you're giving less than the amount that you're supposed to give, then it's still bilas nus. It's still considered to be an illegitimate relationship between the parties. And therefore, what would be a more appropriate clause is for the party simply to say that they leave it in the hands of a particular bezdin to make the determination, if it ever needs to be made, as to how to evaluate the amount. That's lefi aniyus daiti, a better way to go about it. And if they're more comfortable with one bezdin than another, because they think this bezdin is more on their wavelength, then they certainly can pick the bezdin that they're most comfortable with. But it doesn't seem to me that it's even a good idea for the parties to make the determination themselves as to how the ksuva should be evaluated. So this is one issue that comes up regularly, not only in the New York court case, also in the Divrei Malkiel, and you see it in the language of almost every prenuptial agreement. The Rav calling from out in his community in the United States. I try not to identify anybody too specifically who called with this particular shaila. That this is something to be mindful of, even as we generally go out and talk about the get prenuptial agreement or the saving aguna prenuptial agreement. We have real halakhic issues to deal with respect to other prenuptial agreements as well. And that brings us to the other aspect of this type of clause that you see in the prenuptial agreement, and that is this mutual waiver of the parties that they agree that they're not going to inherit from each other. Is this a condition which is included within Tanai Shibimamo, Or is it included within Tanai Sheba Isser? The Ksuva was a problem because it led to the Isser. It is an actual prohibition of a man to be together with his wife without her having the security of a Ksuva. Lechem Mishnah explains that the Bay reason you can't make the condition is because it's a Milsa de Isura. It's not a Dovah Shem Mamon. It's not a monetary matter. It's a Milsa de Isura. It's a matter of prohibition. But what about with respect to Yerusha? What about the waiver of inheritance? So we've already established, so a woman doesn't inherit from her husband anyway. The estate has obligations. The ksuva obligations are not to be taken lightly. She could receive mizonos, be supported from the estate. It's not to be taken lightly, but it's not Yerusha. It's not, strictly speaking, an inheritance. But a husband inherits from his wife. One of the laws of inheritance is that the first person who inherits from a wife is, in fact, her husband, Shera. He's the one who inherits from his wife. There's a dispute among different authorities based on the Gemara, a dispute among Rishonim as to whether this particular inheritance is an inheritance from the Torah, that's the Shita of the Rashba, or whether this is an inheritance midrabanan, whether this is only considered to be a rabbinic inheritance, that's the Shita of the Tosfos Arid, appears to be the Shita of the Rambam as well. That the Yerusha of a husband is only midrabanan, but whether it's the Araisa or whether it's the Rabbanan, it still is an inheritance. Is inheritance something which is which you can make a condition about? Is that a Tanai Shebimamon? Is it a monetary type of matter? Or do we say that this is somehow outside of the realm of Dovah Shebimamon, or that there's some other reason why somebody would not be able to make a condition with respect to inheritance? So this question is dealt with in the Gemara in Baba Basra and Daf Kavkavav Amud Beis, based on the Mishnah over there. The Mishnah in Baba Basra and Daf Kavkavav Amud Beis says that a man is not allowed to cause somebody who is not an heir of his to inherit from himself. If he says, my son, who would otherwise be entitled to inherit, is not entitled to inherit, then his words are batul mevutul, his words are completely void. And the Gemara asks, how can such a thing be? Maybe this is not going according to Rabbi Yehuda. Thank you very much. Meima masisin deloka Rabbi Yehuda. So after all, Rabbi Yehuda says that you can make conditions with respect to monetary matters. The Rabbi Yehuda ha'amah b'davah shabamamon tano kayim. Rabbi Yehuda says when it comes to monetary matters, you are allowed to make a condition. And the Gemara brings the case of the man who betroths a woman on condition that he's not going to be required to give her food and clothing. Share ksus, harezu mikudeshis, according to Rabbi Yehuda, to know kayim, the condition is considered to be valid. So says the Gemara, no. Our Mishnah, when it comes to inheritance law, and which says that you cannot make stipulations, that you cannot make these tanoim conditions with respect to inheritance law, that people who are not supposed to inherit you will, or people who will inherit you won't, that is going afilu tema Rabbi Yehuda, that's going even according to Rabbi Yehuda, because when it comes to marrying a woman, so she is knowingly waiving her rights. Hasam yada v'kamachla, she's waiving her rights, therefore we said, according to the Rashba, you need a mechila, right? We have a mechila, we have a forgiveness on her part. Hacha lo kamachio, but in this particular case, there is no mechila. There is no mechila. The yoresh is not mochil. The yoresh is not giving up his rights. It's just the morish, the one who is the person who is bequeathing his possessions. So that person is disinheriting one of his heirs, but the heir wants nothing to do with it. So therefore, this is not a valid condition. So that would seem to beg the question, what if the heir was willing to forgive? Here I have a husband and wife, a husband's willing to forgive. Or you have a son who's willing to forgive the inheritance from his father. So what if the heir says, that's fine, Papa, I'm happy not to go along with it. So if you look in the comments of the Nemuke Yosef to that Gemara, the Nemuke Yosef seems to suggest that maybe if a person just outright forgave, the heir said, it's okay, I'll do without the inheritance, maybe that would work. But he also suggests maybe it wouldn't work. What he says is that really we're not in any way rejecting the notion that this is a davishim mamon. We're not rejecting that this is a monetary matter. But technically speaking, the heir has no ability, he says, to be Michael or Yerusha, to forego his inheritance because it hasn't yet come into his hands. You can't, therefore, according to his opinion, you can't forego something which hasn't come into his hands. And then he says, and even if you could, you can't read too much into the fact that the heir is silent, that the son says nothing when the father says, son, I'm just going to disinherit you, okay? And the son doesn't say anything because maybe out of respect for his father, he didn't say anything, but really he's not so happy about being disinherited. But according to that second explanation, maybe if he would indicate that he's very happy about being disinherited, maybe in fact then he could be disinherited. So it's left a little bit oblique one way or the other as to whether in fact the a condition to cause somebody who would otherwise receive an inheritance to not receive the inheritance could under any circumstances be valid. But if you look in the Rashba in that Gemara, the Rashba says, don't take the Gemara so seriously. The Gemara seems to indicate that it depends on whether the son is Michael, the son's not Michael. He says, there's no such thing. You can't be Michael Yerusha. You cannot forgive something which is an inheritance. And therefore, even if the son would get up and he would say quite explicitly, Papa, I forego my inheritance, it would be absolutely meaningless. He could not forego his inheritance. And in fact, there is even a sefer that I came across called the Sefer Eretz Tzvi that's brought in the Otzah Meforshim on the Rosh. If you look, if you have a Vilna HaKadosh Shas, and you look in the Hagos of the Rosh on the Sugya, so he quotes the Sefer Eretz Tzvi, who says as following. As follows, he says, "V'chacham echad sheyichye." He says, "A very wise man, he should live and be well." Hera Li showed me shehigia b'shas shelo, that he actually changed the wording in his shas. Now I don't know by dint of what authority this chacham changed the wording in his shas. The implication might be that he saw some ancient manuscript and did it on that basis, but he doesn't really elaborate. The Kitzarech Lomar, and he says in his shas, that when it comes to inheritance, even if the son would forgive the inheritance explicitly, the forgiveness would not count. You can never, under any circumstances, make a condition with respect to Yerusha, and therefore it simply does not work. Now, the Rambam really comes in with a completely different approach than even taking out or changing the Girsa of the Gemara. The Rambam goes even further, and he throws in a new concept entirely that doesn't appear to have any basis in the Gemara at all. This you'll find in the Rambam in Perek Aleph of Hilchos Nachalos. You'll find it also in Hilchos Ishus in Perek Yud Beis, where the Rambam says, you can't make a condition with respect to Yerusha. You know why? Because this is not your normal type of davishim b'mamon. This is not your normal type of monetary condition, because the Torah in Parshas Pinchas, when it talks about the scheme of inheritance law, the Torah describes inheritance as chukas mishpat. It refers to inheritance as something which is on a very lofty level of a chok, of an unbreakable law that was given to us by the Torah. And since the Torah uses this very strong language of a chok, therefore, the indication is, says the Rambam, that this is something which is completely non-negotiable and cannot be subject to any tanai. It cannot be subject to any condition. So that is with respect to Yerusha in general. But the Rambam's drasha from Chukas Mishpat, it should be noted, has no clear basis. You won't find it in any Gemara. You'll find the Me'iri on the Gemara in Baba Basra, who says it's Remuza b'Midrashos, that it is hinted at in various Midrashos, and you'll find whoever wrote the footnotes for the Me'iri, at least in this base Medrash, who says, Eineni Yodea Eifo Zedimtza, a language along those lines. I have no idea what Medrash the Me'iri could be referring to. The Chazon Ish suggests that the Drasha of the Rambam is not a real Drasha, but Lemaisa certainly sounds like the Rambam, like it's a real drasha. The way that the Rambam presents it, he quotes it very clearly and quotes what the ramifications are of this drasha of Chukas Mishpat. Problem is, Gemara itself doesn't appear to be entirely consistent with respect to this issue. And the one exception that you'll find in the Gemara is specifically in the domain of a husband waiving his rights to inherit his wife. And that is a sugya at the beginning of Perek HaKosev in Ksuvos. That is Daf Pei Gimel Amud Aleph in the Gemara in Ksuvos. Where the Gemara in Pei Gimel Amud, the Mishnah, and Pei Gimel Amud Aleph in Ksuvos says that if a man should say to his wife, this is the, it's a machlokas between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. A man says, cuss of law, he writes to his wife. Normally a husband has the right to enjoy the fruits of his wife's estate, even during their lifetime. But he says, dinu dvar mainly b'neksayach. I have no rights to your possessions, or peyosen, or peyosen, any of your possessions, b'chayayach, in your lifetime. That's the easy part. Uven mosech, not only that, even after Me'av Esrim, still would have no rights to inherit his wife. Eino ochel peyos b'chayeh, doesn't eat the fruit in her lifetime, fine. V'mesa eino yorsha. And if she passes away, doesn't inherit her. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omer, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel comes along and he says, imesa yirashena. No such thing. This is an inheritance. You can't waive an inheritance. V'pnei shemasne mashakasa b'torah, v'kol amasne mashakasa b'torah t'nal batel. He's making a condition with respect to what's written in the Torah. You make a condition with respect to what's written in the Torah. The Tanai, the condition is invalid. And if you look at the Gemara kind of sounds like that's the final word, because the Gemara has a lengthy discussion about how Rav holds like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, that you cannot make a condition in this case, and therefore, even if the husband made the condition, he would in fact inherit his wife. Comes along the Rif, and the Rif says, we don't paskin like Rav, we don't paskin like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, we paskin that in fact a husband can waive his right to inherit his wife. And he quotes a Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi says that this was considered to be very standard practice. It was very standard practice that parties, a husband and wife, would make these prenuptial agreements when they would get married, that they would stipulate very specifically with respect to the dowry that was brought into the marriage by the wife's father, that they would make a stipulation that if the wife would unfortunately pass away, and she would pass away without any children, so there were no children to inherit the whatever was born into the whatever the dowry was. Then the dowry would basically return to the father-in-law, and the husband wouldn't keep it. This was the lashon was imisas belobanai komai dila tehad lebeinasha. That if she should die without children, then whatever she had would return to the father's family. Tanai mamonu v'kayim. The Rishami says that's considered to be a valid condition, and the condition is perfectly enforceable. While the Baal HaMa'or there disagrees with the Rif, the Ramban, in his commentary, the Milchamos, agrees wholeheartedly with the Psak of the Rif, and he explains that if you look at the beginning of the Gemara, in Pei Gimel Amud Aleph, it seems to say very explicitly that, of course, we hold that the husband can, in fact, waive his right to inherit his wife. And this is in the statement in the Gemara over there. The Gemara asks, how can this type of statement of the husband work? And the Gemara says, "Bekosev la ve'oda arusa," that the husband writes this for his wife when she is betrothed. Kinder Rav Kahana, as Rav Kahana says, "Nachla haba li adam mimakom acher adam masne aleh shelo yirashena." That if there's an inheritance that's coming to a person from another place, in other words, an inheritance that's not automatic, that the person would not otherwise be entitled to. So before they receive that entitlement, they have the ability to stop it from being chal, to stop it from becoming effective in the first place. And this is a specific reference to the ability of the husband to waive his wife rights to his wife's inheritance. But, says the Gemara, it only works before he actually has the right to receive the inheritance. A husband only has the right to receive inheritance from his wife when he actually marries her. It's a special halacha. Even though he's considered married when he betroths her, when you have erusin, when he doesn't have the right to inherit her until they're actually married, on the cusp of marriage.
there were a couple of cases where she's given over to the husband's family, but essentially not until she's actually married, where there's actual nisuin between the wife and the husband, does the husband inherit the wife. So therefore, he cannot make this waiver after nisuin. He can't make the waiver after they're already full-fledged married after the chuppah. He has to do it after erusin. He has to do it. It used to be there was a 12-month gap between the time of erusin and the time of nisuin. You'd have a 12-month gap, or at least some significant gap, and during that time, that's when he can make this waiver. But otherwise, after the nisuin is going to be too late. And says the Ran, in the name of the Ramban, that before the erusin is going to be too early. Then in order to make this a type of waiver of inheritance, it has to be at this small window of opportunity between the erusin and the nisuin. But before the erusin, he has absolutely nothing to do with her assets, so it doesn't make sense for him to waive his right to them. And after the nisuin, it's too late because of the fact that he's already worthy of inheriting her. What is the explanation for this? So Ramban explains the explanation without having to resort to the Rambam's definition of Yerusha as a chukas mishpat. He says, technically speaking, really, in any type of Yerusha situation, you could have had a waiver because it really is a monetary matter. It doesn't accept this chukas mishpat definition. It really is a monetary matter. Practically speaking, it doesn't work. Practically speaking, it doesn't work because in most situations of Yerusha, in most situations of inheritance, the heir already, as soon as they're born, has the ability to inherit from the other person. Therefore, it's something which is considered to be already designated for them. And once it's already designated for them, they can't get rid of it by a mere stipulation. They would have to actually give it away. But they can't give it away either because they don't have it yet to give it away. So since they have neither the ability to stipulate because of the fact that it already is something that is designated for them, and nor do they have the ability to give it away and stipulate about giving it away because it's not yet actually in their possession, so therefore as a technical matter, generally speaking, when it comes to Yerusha, you can't make tanaim, but it's purely a technical matter. Not a chukas mishpat per se, it's purely a technical matter. But when it comes to a husband and a wife, so whether it's the Rabbanon, whether it's only a rabbinic inheritance, or whether it's the Araisa, or whether it is a Torah inheritance, either way, the husband has this ability to waive the Yerusha, but only during this very small window of time before he has become like all the other Yorshim by virtue of entering into a Nisuin. It has to be between the betrothal and the Nisuin. During that window of time, the waiver and the condition would be able to take place. And there's third approach, that approach of a third approach. So you have to summarize the two approaches. First approach is the Rambam, who says that every single Yerusha is chukas mishpat, and therefore you're never allowed to do a waiver. So why then, according to the Rambam, does he say you can do a waiver in the case of a wife? So Rambam says it's not the chukas mishpat until the time of Nisuin. Before the time of Nisuin, we don't give it the status of chukas mishpat, therefore the waiver could take place beforehand. The Rambam also throws in that he holds that the Yerusha, the inheritance of her husband, is only rabbinic, but he doesn't necessarily make it dependent on that. Second explanation is that of the Ramban, that technically speaking, really Yerusha is a davar shebamamon, it's really a monetary matter, and you could normally make a condition with respect to Yerusha. It's just that as a technical matter, you can't, because most Yerushim, most heirs already have the Yerusha roi, worthy and designated for them to receive, and therefore a mere stipulation alone is not going to be sufficient to remove them from Yerusha. They'd have to actually give it away, and they can't give it away because it's a davish lo bal yado. It's something which they don't physically actually have yet, except for the case of a husband who does not even have the worthiness of inheriting his wife until the time of Nisuin. Therefore, between the time of the Eris and the time of Nisuin, he has the ability to waive. And the third approach you'll find in the Rashi, in Tosa Sarid, is the approach that says, no, Yerusha of a husband is different because it's the Rabbanon, because it's rabbinic. And therefore, we're more lenient when it comes to a rabbinic inheritance, that we have a special proviso. When it comes to rabbinic inheritance, the rabbinic inheritance, we say that until a person actually has it on their plate, We have a special dispensation that a person has the right to waive it, but if it would be a ricin evidence, if it would be min ha-Torah, so then we wouldn't provide any such dispensation, even if it was before the Nisuin, maybe because they also hold by some esoteric notion of chukas mishpat like the Rambam, without saying it explicitly. But with all of this explanation, where we have essentially concluded like the Ramban, and we paskin halacha l'maisa like the Ramban, and the Rambam also holds this way, that between the Erusin and Nisuin, this type of stipulation can be made. When are you going to make the stipulation in our contemporary prenuptial agreements? If the only time that a husband has the right to waive his Yerusha from his wife is between the Erusin and the Nisuin, how much time do we have between our Erusin and our Nisuin, generally speaking? Sorry? 5 minutes. 5 minutes, if you're lucky. Nowadays, the new minhag is that they don't even make speeches anymore. It's usually even less than 5 minutes. The erusin is right under the chuppah. The husband gives his wife the ring. They say berachas erusin. Somebody reads the ksuva, and then they have the nisuin immediately afterwards. We don't have a long break. We don't have a long period. And we don't generally have lawyers negotiating contracts underneath the chuppah. They used to. But we don't generally have lawyers negotiating contracts underneath the chuppah. So therefore, when are you going to do it? So the chavos yair, of Yair Bachrach, famous posek from Germany a few hundred years ago, asked this question already. He said, I don't understand, because there are plenty of people getting married where this was a concern, where they wanted to protect the assets of the woman, and this was a condition that they wanted to enter into. They wanted to do this type of prenuptial agreement. He said, I don't know how we're going to go about doing it, because before the Erusin is too early, after the Nisuin is too late. So he suggests that maybe he said that in certain communities, they actually had a minig of doing certain kinyanim underneath the chuppah, and if you do it after the erusin, and even though they're saying the brachos of sheva brachos, but they do the contract before the chassan and the kali eat in the yichud room, so until they've actually eaten something, so then the whole thing isn't really finished. I don't know exactly what it's based upon. He says that the marriage really ends when they eat something, but until they eat something, so then it's still a work in progress. So as long as they do it before they eat something, so that it's considered before the Nisuin, and they should do it at that time. But he points out that this isn't really the way that it is generally done. And others wanted to argue that maybe you don't have to paskin like the Ran. Maybe the Ran says that before the Erusin is too early. So the Ksam Sofer, for example, says that, why is it too early? Because you can't really rescind something which is a completely davar shelo bal yolam, something which hasn't come into the world at all. But if they already have a relationship, they're already engaged to each other, there's already some sort of relationship, so maybe it's okay to do it at that point in time, at least after they've signed the tanoim. Because once they've signed the tanoim, so then they're kind of stuck with each other, there are all kinds of penalties for breaking the engagement. But the problem with that suggestion is that nowadays we don't usually sign tanoim. If we do sign to, when we do sign to nine, we sign it also at the same exact point in time, which is right before the wedding. When it's time to sign, you sign the tanoim. You have no time to think anymore after you sign the tanoim. You start playing music and breaking plates, and you can't concentrate. So chances are nobody's going to enter into a contract at that point in time either. So even that solution doesn't quite work. The Pesachei Tshuva and Evin Ezer quotes from one of the authorities who said that if he would end up with a prenuptial agreement where they had basically agreed that the husband wouldn't inherit his wife, but they did it before the Erusin, so he wouldn't rely upon it exclusively. He would make some sort of compromise between the parties, but he would be worried about relying upon it completely. So you're kind of stuck. What do you do? So the Nachla Shiva was the same one who came up with the form that we predicated our famous Beis Din prenuptial agreement upon, has a form of a shtar siluk, of a husband basically removing himself from the right to his wife's assets, both in her lifetime and afterwards. And he has it for after the Nisuin. He has it to take place after the marriage has already set in. And what's his basis? His basis is, he says, well, if you do it with an actual kinyan, you do an actual kinyan, so the Gemara indicates that kanu miyado, if you have an actual bona fide real transaction of, you lift the handkerchief, you do like a real kinyan, so you have a kanu miyado, so then that's even stronger, and that could be done after the Nisuin. And he, as an explanation, he says, the Rambam holds this way. The only problem is that if you look in the Rambam goes out of his way to tell you that he doesn't hold this way. The Rambam says that a kinyan works with respect to a husband removing his rights to his wife's possessions during her lifetime with respect to the peiros, to the fruit of her assets, but says explicitly, but that doesn't work when it comes to Yerusha. It doesn't work when it comes to inheritance. If he doesn't spell it out clearly, the Rebbe, the Magen Mishnah, or the commentaries on the Rebbe, on the Rambam spell it out quickly, and the Shulchan Aruch paskins that way as well. As the Chokas Mechokik and Beis Shmuel point out in the Shulchan Aruch, that if there's a Kinyan, it doesn't help for the right of the husband to be able to abrogate a Yerusha, to be able to remove himself from Yarshining his wife. So the whole form of the Nachman Shiva seems problematic. We had a fellow in Yeshiva a few months ago who was getting married, and where the families wanted to enter into this type of prenuptial agreement where he would waive his rights to Yerusha. They should live and be well, it shouldn't be, but this was something that they wanted to enter into. And he asked around, what should he do? So somebody gave him the form of the Nachman Shiva. So I just gave him a Mara Malkam. I said, look in the Chavos Yair, you know, if you followed up or not. But the Nachla Shiva is very problematic. And in fact, some of the Achronim even point out that the formulation of the Nachla Shiva is very problematic. So what then do you do, halacha l'maisa, nowadays, to enter into this type of clause? Generally speaking, the people will want to enter into these contracts before the marriage as opposed to after the marriage. But there are a couple of solutions. One solution, which is mentioned by the Ramban, for after the marriage, is that the contract could read not that the husband is removing his wife's is repudiating his rights to inherit his wife, but that he accepts that he's going to inherit his wife. It's just that he agrees that once he inherits his wife, he's taking upon an obligation that he's going to give the money to his wife's heirs. So if it's formulated in that fashion, then everybody agrees that works. The Ramah quotes that in the name of the Ramban, that for sure should work. So that is one way to finesse the problem in terms of the language, certainly if it's done after the Nisuin. If it's done before the Erisin, the prenuptial agreements, nobody says explicitly that language would work. Maybe it's premature for the husband to assume the obligation at that point. That's not entirely certain. But what could be done, what's suggested by the Avodas HaGershuni, this is in the Chavos Yair Siman Nun, the first tshuva, the Chavos Yair Siman Mem Zayin, the Avodas HaGershuni suggests that if they stipulate that they're doing it in such a way that it's meant to be effective, then maybe that sometimes makes things effective. You can certainly argue with that, because either it is effective or it's not effective, but if you stipulate that you kind of deem it to be as if it's being entered into between the Eris and Nisuin, it's considered like the husband has it in mind between the Eris and Nisuin, so that certainly can make it more powerful. So based on all these considerations, the sooner that it's entered into, or the later it's entered into, I should say, closer to the actual marriage ceremony, where you either have tanoim or you have other types of firm commitments between the husband and the wife, and you have this type of language that it's deemed as if it's repeated between the Erisin and Nisuin, and there are some Meforshim, the Avnei Miluim and others, who suggest that if you do it as a tanai mamash, you make it clear that it's a full-fledged Lashon Tanai, and you insert that type of language in the agreement, that could make it even more forceful. So if you include all of these different belts and suspenders, all of these different trimmings in the package, then that certainly will make it at least more palatable. You have more to rely upon, but essentially it's important to note that the enterprise is fundamentally problematic. On the other hand, it also reveals something else which is interesting on two levels. One is that Yerusha, inheritance matters, even though they appear to be purely monetary in nature, are actually considered by certain authorities like the Rambam to be off limits. The same way you can't waive Iksuva, you can't waive Yerusha, it's considered to be in a rarefied special category, something akin to a Milsa D'Isur, something akin to a Davashe B'Isur, like a prohibited matter that you can't make conditions about as a general principle. And the other interesting thing is that although many of us already have that in our heads for many years, that Yerusha is non-negotiable and you can't make conditions with respect to Yerusha, it's not necessarily agreed across the board that this is actually the case. And if you look at the various Gemaras, it appears that if not, and according to many Rishonim like the Ramban, if not for very technical impediments, really Yerusha is something that you could have waived under normal circumstances, and that you could have made conditions about Yerusha under normal circumstances. And even the Rambam seems to indicate that whenever you don't have a chukas mishpat type of consideration, like when you're dealing with Yerushas that are more rabbanan, are more rabbinical in nature, At least at a point in time before we enact a chukas mishpat, that there's more flexibility with respect to making conditions. I won't go into it, but there's another Rambam in Hilchos Nachlos Perek Vav, in which the Rambam says this explicitly with respect to the rabbinical Yerusha, that a convert inherits from his father, even though his father is now Jewish and there's no longer a halakhic relationship, that's a rabbinical inheritance. And the Rambam goes out of his way to say, Yiroya Li, that it seems to me that this would be subject to tonight, that you could make a condition on this. And the Rav Elvela Soloveitchik and the Chidush Agriz explains, because there's no chukas mishpat with respect to this particular Yerusha. You only have the Dovash Mimomon, the monetary aspect of Yerusha. Whenever you only have the monetary aspect of Yerusha, therefore it could be subject to Tanai, it could be subject to conditions. I'd just like to conclude with the observation, says Derech Chidud B'Alma, that we learn all of Hilchos Tanayim, and we learn the essential principles of Hilchos Tanayim from B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven. And what were they talking about over there? They were talking about Nachla. They were talking about inheriting the land, so that we actually learn the basic laws of Yerusha and Tanai Shemimam and what's considered to be monetary matter from a Yerusha that appeared to be an actual inheritance. And maybe, and I say this only Derech Chidud B'Alma, without being Ma'ayin significantly bedover, that maybe that's the vort, that the B'nai Gad of B'nai Reuven needed for this condition to be made precisely when they were Be'ever Hayadim, because they were stipulating with respect to what they would otherwise be receiving on the other side of Eretz Yisrael, which was the Nachla that was worthy of them. Once they would already be on the other side of Eretz Yisrael, it would be too late to make the Tanai, something that wasn't Bali Yadu yet. When they were before Eber Yarding, therefore it was too premature for them to be able to make a Tanai along these lines. Therefore, it had to be precisely at this point in time between when they got to the Eber Yarding before they got to Eretz Yisrael. We call Nachla Bali Yadu Mimakum Achir, that it's a Nachla inheritance that they will be receiving from another place that they haven't yet arrived to. So then they would have the ability to make the Tanai, to make the stipulation at that point in time. I say that again, Derech Chidud B'Alma. But the one observation in connection with the Tanai B'nai Gad, B'nai Reuven, relating to my father, Zichrono Levracha, is that we're told that when you make Tanayim, when you make conditions, you have to be very specific of doing it in the right order. You have to place your priorities correctly. It has to be Tanai Kodim L'maise, the condition before the action, and it has to be Hein Kodim L'lav, the positive before the negative, of a number of different stipulations. And Moshe Rabbeinu was actually critical. If you look in Perek Lamed Beis in Pasuk Tes Zayin, so Moshe Rabbeinu says Rashi was critical because they seemed to mix up at least their priorities in one respect. When the B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven first went to Moshe, they had their order wrong in terms of what their emphasis was about as to why they wanted to remain in the Eber Liardin. They had abundant flock, and they also wanted to provide for their children. But instead of placing their children first, they placed the flock first. They said, Gidros son of Nelik McNeinu Po, we want to have proper facilities for our sheep. And then afterwards they said, V'arim letapenu, and then only afterwards they said, in cities for our children. And Rashi says, Chosim hayu amamonim yotim ibneim avinoseim. They care more about their money than about their sons and daughters. Sheikdimu McNeim letapam, that they actually put the flock first before their own children. Amalham Moshe said to them, Lochem, you want me to do this deal with you? I'll do the deal with you. I'll make the condition and so forth. But you got to get the order straight. And the order is, Asu ikar ikar ve'atofel tofel. Make what's get your priorities straight. Benu lachem tzachila arim letapchem ve'achakach gidros litzonachem. First, build the cities for your children. That has to be your emphasis. And then afterwards, you worry about taking care of your sheep. It could be that the B'nai Gad of B'nai Reuven really were ultimately caring about their children. They wanted the flock to be prosperous so they'd be able to provide for their children. But sometimes people can make a mistake. They get so obsessed with what they're doing in life, even though it's ultimately for the purpose of the family, they forget what the ultimate purpose is all about. And they forget to put the ultimate purpose first. And Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, make sure that you put the ultimate purpose first. And in all of one's travels in life, one has to constantly keep that in mind, that it's not about what you're accomplishing at this stage or at that stage or the other stage. It's about how am I perpetuating my relationship with my children? How am I passing on what I have inherited myself to make sure that my children receive my values, to make sure that my children receive my traditions, to make sure that my children get the full benefit of the paternal bond that I am able to provide for them? And this is something which is underscored in Rashi. I wrote Dvarim here. It's also Bemidbar in Parshas Maaseh, whereas all of the different travels were being recounted of the time that Bnei Yisrael spent in the desert. So Rashi quotes from Rabbi Tanhuma, Adrasha, Mashal Melech, Shehaya bin Ocholet, it's like a king whose son was sick, Valicha Lamakam Rachok Raposo, and he took him to a far place to cure him, Kimen Shayu Chosvin, when they went back, Hiskel Avi Monek Kolamasos, and he says to the son, Amalo Kanyashneinu, Kanu Karnu, Kanachashtes Roshcha, this is the place where we slept. This is the place where it's a little cold. This is the place where you had a bit of a headache, where the entire emphasis, the entire thinking is not, this is the place where we took care of this part of the business. This is the place where I took care of that part of the business. This is the place where this is what happened to you. My main focus is you. My main focus is you, the son. With everything that's going on, with all the business we need to take care of, the main focus that a father needs to have is with respect to the child. To tell you, all of my years of growing up, I don't remember my father really ever speaking to me, except when I forced him to, about his business, about, well, he didn't have business, about his work. Even as a town councilman, I didn't speak to him about town affairs. Our relationship was very much about the father-son relationship. I got a speeding ticket. He went with me to the police station to negotiate the speeding ticket with me. I needed to get my car fixed, so he went with me to the car shop to get the car fixed with me. These were the types of, this was the relationship that was forged. This was the sense of priority that my father taught me, that the Torah teaches us that we should have with respect to our children. Everybody has very important lives, which we're doing Dvarim Ha'omdim Rumo Shel Olam, and everybody needs to make a parnasa, and everybody needs to focus on all these very important matters, but it's essential to maintain at all times the sense of priority, the sense that our major responsibility is with respect to our children, to those who we're responsible for taking care of, Talmidim also, but the individuals in our life whom we have an impact upon, those have to come first. But so, the flocks, the business, the work, the other accomplishments, that's all secondary, that's all tafil, that's all to enable us, like you're learning about Ikka v'tafil, in case in Mevarchin, but the tafil, in life, the tafil are all the parnasa considerations and other considerations. The Ikka consideration is one of family and transmitting our values to our family. Baruch Hashem, my father was very careful to transmit his love of Yiddishkeit, his love of Torah, his love of Klal Yisrael, of Eretz Yisrael, to all of his children, and we should just be zoche to carry on in that tradition and to be able to pass on the same values to our children. Thank you very, very much for coming.
Two things. Number one, when I entered the rabbi,